Cruise it through the Arizona Hour with Sanderson Ford and Rosie on the House.
What made this such an infamous gunfight as opposed to some of the others, this fight left three widows and 19 children without a father.
I mean, it's Arizona's deadliest gunfight, more deadly than the shootout at the OK Corral.
And the interesting thing, we're talking with author Heidi Osler. You're a local state historian, and on your book, Arizona's Deadliest Gunfight, Draft Resistance and Tragedy at the Power Cabin, 1918. Looking at this picture of the cabin that still stands, and you mentioned in the preface that some lawyers from Tucson a decade or so ago went out and helped re-support it, and they didn't refurbish it, they just reinforced the structural
integrity.
They did.
They brought in some new logs where it was collapsing and rebuilt it.
And it's completely surrounded by hills and the vegetation growth. It was four on four, four guys inside, four guys outside. You would think the four guys inside wouldn't stand a chance.
Right.
You've got 1918, so they're probably using lever-action rifles. They've probably got revolvers. Each of these officers probably have 12 bullets total without having to reload. Four guys shooting inside. It'd be like shooting fish in the barrel. But the guys inside, you know, you would think the death toll would be reversed. Three died inside, one outside, but it was three outside, one inside. And he wasn't even inside. He was walking out the door.
I don't think the lawmen wanted to kill them. They wanted to capture them, bring them to justice. To me, that's absolutely right. It's crazy. But the lawmen just stood out in the open. They didn't take cover. And so I think they were just standing in front, except for the federal marshal, who was the most experienced of the lawmen. He'd been in law 10 years. He was kind of around behind the back. And it's obvious from his testimony he didn't see a whole lot because he didn't have a good view. But the other three Graham County lawmen were in plain sight. And when the power boys got out of bed and started shooting, they were right outside the window. So, yeah, they went down. Two of the deputies went down with one shot towards, you know, both of them back of the head. And then the sheriff was shot from somebody laying in the shed area, was down on the ground shooting up, and they shot him in the knee and then the stomach. And then something strange happened because he was shot through the head. And we aren't sure why, but when you have a stomach injury and you're out in the middle of nowhere, it's a very painful way to die. And I've had a lot of people experienced in this say that normally when that happens, somebody gives the victim a gun and they take care of themselves. But there was also accusations that the powers did that. And so, of course, that was played up at the subsequent trial.
And your husband have acted this gunfight out.
Yes.
Who won?
You know, I think there was no winners here.
No, I meant between you and your husband.
Oh, well.
Tom's in studio with us.
Yeah.
The powers usually come out ahead because three of them survived. But in the end, both sides lost quite a bit. You heard the Marshall Trimble in that clip say how many children were left without children, without fathers. It was a horrible tragedy.
The second most fascinating part of this story is the federal marshal, Frank Haynes. So he's behind the building, and the shooting's going out towards the front where the lawmen are. He takes off when the fighting breaks out. It took them all night to get there. They're traveling at dark, very rough mountains, understood. This is about 7:30 in the morning. This is 1918. He's back in Safford sending a telegram by noon.
Yes, he is.
That must have been the ride of a lifetime.
It was.
Going down that mountain.
They said that was. He just flew down to the little town of Klondike, which was the closest place where they had left their Model T coming up. He realized when he got there that he didn't have the key to the car, and they had, because it was in the sheriff's pocket and he lay dead up at the cabin, so they had to hotwire the car. Somebody figured out how to do that real quick, and then he drove putt, you know, maybe 35 mile an hour.
The horse was going almost as fast as a 1918 Model T
into Safford, and he got that telegram off to Washington D.C. by noon, And it sat in a federal bureaucrat's desk for several days because it was Sunday and nobody paid any attention to it.
But so that was in D.C. But locally, they had a 11-man posse back up to the cabin within 24 hours.
They were up there real quick. And also there was posse on the ground out Reddington, which was just east of where they were or west of where they were. The shootout was, and they almost caught them. But then the three men, the fugitives, took...
I don't want to spoil it because next segment we'll talk about that because it's still, if I remember correctly, and I only had like 3 days to do the research, but this led to the biggest manhunt in Arizona history.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll talk about the next 28 days after the gunfight, the trial, and ultimately what has happened.
Okay.
101 years ago come next... next Sunday, February 10th, will be the 101st anniversary. So if you're listening, you can text to 411-923. What is the date of this? And we've got Arizona State Passes tickets that will send to any right winner between now and the end of the news break. What date was Arizona's deadliest gunfight? Text the answer to 411-923 for a chance at Arizona State Park Passes.